Well, would you please turn back in the Bibles to Proverbs chapter 1. It's page 635. They didn't warn us that we need a mountaineering course now. We've moved from St. Helens. All these pulpits at St. Botolph's here are so much higher. But there we are. Proverbs chapter 1. As I set out on my holiday at the beginning of August, I happened to read in the Times for that day an article which gave the results of a survey that had been done to just try and see how much residual knowledge of Christianity was around in the country. The results were depressing. Let me just quote one or two excerpts for you. Asked to quote any verse from the Bible other than the Lord's Prayer, 50%, 73% of students who regularly did worse than everyone else, 50%, 73% of students were unable to do so. The response of one student wit just about summed up the situation. Jesus wept. Even identification of biblical passages and phrases from the liturgy was poor. Many of those who identified "in the beginning was the Word" believed it came from Genesis rather than correctly from John's Gospel. And again, it was students who showed least familiarity with the Bible and liturgy. Also, while most people believe they conduct their private and public lives in accordance with Christian morality, this is not supported by any close analysis of what in detail that constitutes, which isn't surprising if you know no more verses of the Bible. It must be emphasized, here is the shocking bit, that the survey sample was by no means a cross-section of the population. It's taken amongst three groups: first-year university students, school teachers, and professionals aged 40 to 60. All had been born in this country and were not active adherents of any religion other than Christianity. The survey was deliberately designed to produce a best possible scenario. What these people do not know is unlikely to be known or passed on to future generations. That's not the sort of article to read as you go off on holiday, is it? I couldn't avoid thinking we have enough experience to realize that even if the precise percentages aren't right, that is not that wildly an inaccurate picture of where we are now. That's the society and the world we're living in. What's going to be the antidote? Where do we start? Who will pass this knowledge on to anyone else? I spent my summer holiday dreaming, of course, of here's St. Helens Superchurch, whatever it may be. The article refers to schools, refers to church. Talia might have been recruiting for part of the answer. But then I turned to what King Solomon had to say. Now, he knows a thing or two, as you know, and it's very striking when you look at the book of Proverbs and see, how is any of this knowledge, how is any of this wisdom to be passed on to anyone else? And he points not at church, not at school, not at Sunday school, but at the home, at the family. The voice of wisdom, wisdom's voice, is a parent's voice. Look at verse 8 of chapter 1, will you? Listen, my son, to your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. In the Israel of the day, the wise teacher and the wise parent spoke with the same voice. It's one of the marks of this book. You'll find that the phrase, my son, keeps on and on recurring. See, it's here, verse 8, listen, my son. Verse 10, my son. Verse 15, my son. The teacher of all this wisdom in this book teaches as if he were a parent. Turn over a couple of pages, will you, for a moment. Don't lose Proverbs 1. It's where we're coming back to rest every time. But the beginning of chapter 4. Listen, my sons, to a father's instruction. Pay attention and gain understanding. I give you sound learning. So do not forsake my teaching. When I was a boy in my father's house, still tender and an only child of my mother, he taught me and said, lay hold of my words with all your heart. Keep my commands and you'll live. Yes, your education is your life. And the education is got from home. You just turn on one more page and you'll see the same theme coming up again. Chapter 6, verse 20. Page 640. My son, keep your father's commands and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Bind them upon your heart forever. Fasten them around your neck. So when the Apostle Paul writes, as we heard in the lesson from Ephesians, fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. That is good wisdom teaching. The Proverbs writers would be beaming all over their faces to hear that. That's why these words we heard in the baptism are all too true. Parents, and godparents we added, but it'll be parents primarily, this child whom you brought for baptism depends chiefly on you for the help and encouragement she needs. Now, if you remember, if you were with us last week, something of the scope of wisdom, which is far wider than being able to quote verses from the Bible. If you remember that it's all about wisdom for life, the skill to handle society and the world we live in, you'll understand why the home has to be the choice. It requires that close an interaction to teach it. I tried this week to do what we suggested last week and read a chapter of Proverbs each day. Here's just a couple of things I found this week. The words of a gossip are like choice morsels. They go down to a man's inmost parts. Any parent realizes that the tendency to gossip starts very, very early. If it's not restrained in the home, it'll be an increasingly difficult job to restrain it anywhere else. Oh, here's one for this morning. I read, a sluggard does not plough in season, so at harvest time he looks but finds nothing. How many weeks is it going to be before some parent says to little Johnny, unless you start doing your homework now, you'll never pass the exam next summer? I mean, you know, these are truths, aren't they, that need to be built into us from the beginning. It's the home that the writer of the Proverbs looks to provide our education. One of the striking things about Proverbs is how the writer emphasizes learning from natural institutions like the family rather than supernatural means. And we shouldn't despise him or think it any the less spiritual because of that. The underlying assumption is that God has arranged society in an ordered way, and the family is part of that order, an integral part. If you think about it, you see, a family is like society in microcosm. In a family, a child can learn, actually must learn, to submit to authority. If I don't learn that lesson, I can never take a proper part in society, can I? In a family, a child has to learn cooperation with others. It's a great learning ground for life. You not only can get taught things in theory, you can see them in practice. Our younger daughter was ill one night last week, and Claire and I were busy clearing up the mess when Anna, our eldest, peered over the top bunk and with a grimace all over her face started watching us. We said, look, darling, if you don't want to look, just roll over and lie down. She said, no, no. We've been told that if we watch what our parents do, then we'll learn how to do it ourselves. Well, roll on the next time Lucy's sick, we know what to do now. And it's very true what she's been told, isn't it? It's rather alarming to realize how many things we've picked up subconsciously just from watching the way our parents went about doing things. Now, I don't want to idealize the family. This is too earthy a book to do that. And, of course, there are, quotes, bad families. Families where parents' ambitions, for example, are thrust and imposed upon their children. So they have to grow up to be tennis stars or concert violinists. And being, quotes, Christian doesn't immunize any family from that kind of thing. Of course there are the so-called bad families, but we're going to have to resist the insidious pressures that undermine the family. It remains God's chosen training ground. And notice, will you, as you come back to chapter 1, verse 8, that it's mothers as well as fathers. Listen, my son, to your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. The Bible may teach wives to submit to their husbands, but it does not teach mothers to submit to their children. Indeed, the last chapter of this book begins like this: the sayings of King Lemuel, an oracle his mother taught him. And he just passes it on. Our General Synod may or may not decide in November to ordain women as priests or presbyters in the Anglican Church, but it really doesn't matter to mothers. Every mother is ordained to this teaching ministry, and there's nothing General Synod can do about it. Now, we're all parents and children, of course, one or the other, or both. But here it's clearly talking about a relationship that many of us have grown at least physically apart from to some degree. And I'm aware there are more adult singles than anyone else here this morning. So let me just put this thought in your minds as we go through, because it may help you to realize these are applications that carry on in many different facets. The wise teacher and the wise parent spoke with the same voice. So if I'm a teacher of wisdom, and to some measure, if I lead a home group, a Read, Mark, Learn group, I'm something of a teacher of wisdom, then I need to think of myself in some measure as a parent, with the range of concerns of a parent. Here, the wise teacher claims parental authority over his pupils. Listen, my son, listen. Matched, as it always should be, by the fatherly concern for their well-being. Nothing is more lethal than when some people want the one, the authority, without the concern. Wisdom's voice, it's a parent's voice. Wisdom's voice, it is an urgent voice. Listen, my son, to your father's instruction. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. Listen. Chapter 4 will begin. Pay attention and gain understanding. Now, any parent knows that, don't we? How we constantly have to repeat what the writer here constantly repeats. We have to constantly tell our children, listen. Listen, it is the most frustrating thing as a parent to realize that you've got information your children do not have, and actually you're not going to ever get it into their heads because they're too busy talking to listen. Well, any teacher of wisdom must face that. If we're going to be disciples, we need to learn that lesson as well ourselves, don't we? We've got to listen. The Archbishop of Canterbury was speaking in New York last week, I think it was, and he gave a great talk on the way the church isn't using gifted laymen properly. You have highly talented men and women, and they come into church, and we treat them as if they're nobodies. Now, much of what he had to say was brilliant. I'm not in any sense wanting to speak against him. I just want to say this, which I'm sure he'd endorse. However gifted someone is, it still remains the mark of the disciple that we listen. Whether you're a preacher or a tycoon, if we won't listen, well, we'll not learn of God. I can't stand on my gifts and ignore this urgent cry that I need to listen to the voice of wisdom. It's an urgent voice, wisdom's voice. It's a commanding voice. The wise parent does not leave his or does not leave the child to make up his or her mind. No one can really bring their children up that way, can they? And certainly this wise parent isn't. Look at verse 10. My son, if sinners entice you, you must think through the best thing to do. Now, if sinners entice you, do not give in to them. Verse 15. My son, do not go along with them. Do not set foot on their paths. They're imperatives. Mothers, fathers, wise teachers are constantly giving imperatives. Do this, don't do that. Now, the context here, you'll remember, is gang pressure. That's basically what it is, peer group pressure. Any child who's going to grow up wise is going to handle this one, aren't they? And it's fatuous to leave them to make up their own minds because it's perfectly obvious which way they'll go. Given no teaching, given no imperatives, given no commands, given no warnings, any child will just go the way of the gang. This garland of verse 9 that'll grace your head, this marvelous jewelry to adorn your neck. It's actually the hard-won beauty of goodness that comes from listening to the wise parent, but it quickly pales beside the glamour and the excitement of the gang. That's where the power lies, doesn't it? That's where the youth can be a person to be reckoned with and not just patronized and kept in place. My son, if sinners entice you, don't give in to them. Verse 11, if they say, come along with us, let's lie in wait for someone's blood, let's waylay some harmless soul, let's swallow them alive like the grave and whole like those who go down to the pit. We'll get all sorts of valuable things and fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot with us and we'll share a common purse. Now, you've only just got to change the words, but the sentiment we've all known, haven't we? We faced that all the way up. We still do. There's only one thing a parent can say when their children are faced with that, and that is, do not. Do not. Parents have to speak like that. At the teenager, I suppose, is the area we focus in and think that that's where peer group pressure is at its highest, but I suspect it never goes away. And I doubt there are many of us here this morning who don't need from time to time to have at least sat and listened and been told again, do not give in. Do not go down that path. Starts a lot younger than teenagers, of course. Starts with the 4 and 5 year olds in the playground. I've had it in our school playground this week. Two youngsters getting into trouble, both blaming each other for doing it. And one of the mums was talking to us and saying what she was going to say to her son. I'm going to have to tell him. It really doesn't matter who started it. If you decide to go along with something, you've got to take the responsibility for it. You can't duck it. You can't just go along because the other's shouting louder and it sounds fun. No, it's a commanding voice, wisdom's voice. It's a motivating voice too. And watch how wisdom motivates. Wisdom motivates by emphasizing the consequences of any path or direction, by pointing out where paths lead to. Look down at verse 15, will you? My son, do not go along with them. Do not set foot on their paths. Why? For their feet rush into sin. They're swift to shed blood. How useless to spread a net in full view of all the birds. These men lie in wait for their own blood. They waylay only themselves. Such is the end of all who go after ill-gotten gain. It takes away the lives of those who get it. Now here's a recurring theme of Proverbs, pointing out where a course of action will lead to. It all sounded immensely attractive in verse 11. Let's lie in wait for someone. Let's waylay someone. By the time you reach verse 16, you discover that the person you're lying in wait for is yourself. And it's your blood that'll be spilt. And it's you that are waylaid. Now, the mark of a child is that a child doesn't understand the consequences of their action. Isn't that true? A parent is constantly pointing out to a child what'll happen if they pursue this course of action. Don't touch. You'll burn yourself. You know, that refrain of every parent, as they see the squabble starting, it'll only end in tears. Now, we're all fed up with that one. We still need to say it. Stay up late, Johnny, and you know perfectly well you won't be able to cope with tomorrow. Johnny, if you're going to keep that kind of company, you're bound to land up in trouble. It's the mark of a child, it's the mark of a fool. It's the mark of the fool in Proverbs. They don't see where their course of action is going to land up. A French criminologist has done a study of French criminals. I don't quite know how he went about this, but he discovered that something like 3/4 of them can only think of the present. As of course, every instinct in us is very strong to just live for the present, isn't it? You don't have to be a French criminal. A friend of mine was telling me about one of those people who's directing him at the moment. She's having an affair with a married man with two children, and he asked her why she was doing it. She said, I'm 33, I've got to enjoy it now. He just said to her, you won't be saying that in 6 months' time. He's almost certainly right, isn't he? Mistresses don't seem to see it, or they don't want to, where these things almost inevitably seem to land up. For the adulterous husbands are far too callous and selfish ever to leave their wives. They just ruin everything. Now, the wise parent, the wise teacher, will be pointing out the consequences. Wisdom's voice does that. You see, it's a parent's voice, it's an urgent voice, it's a commanding voice, it's a motivating voice. Now, next week I want to spend some time going on and looking at the kind of things that Proverbs thinks we should be teaching in the home, but I just want to stop today and think for a moment about some of the consequences and the applications, if what we're seeing this morning is to be true. What the task is that's in front of us. I think it's a very daunting one if responsibility is to be returned to the home and if responsibility is going to be taken up in the home. Now, the government, I heard on the news, are just introducing a new criminal justice bill in which one clause will allow the courts to fine parents if children are guilty of serious shoplifting. Well, I suppose that's an incentive to take up responsibility in the home. Though Proverbs distinguishes between the responsibility for teaching and the responsibility for learning. And that is an important point, or we get all kinds of false guilt. And when you look across the range of policies, I'm afraid the government appears very inconsistent in their attitude to family life. I don't think we can rely on legislation doing this job for us. It's ironical, isn't it, that that kind of a measure is being introduced just at the very time when our family life and home life must be at about its weakest, certainly for centuries. We were talking about this yesterday with Chris Green, and he, I suspect rightly, said, look, we're still sowing in this area, aren't we? We haven't reaped the whirlwind yet. And yet we're going to have to counter what undermines the family. It's going to involve us in moral battles and political battles and philosophical, theoretical battles with some of the implicit, explicit consequences of some feminist thinking, some of the gay movement. But we're going to have to be more positive than just that. I think it means we're going to have to take more seriously our own family lives. You see, when we come to see something of the range of things that the wise teacher will be passing on, well, the task gets even more daunting. It's too big for a St. Helens or any church on a Sunday morning. Oh, we'll start rejoicing in a new way, I hope, at Christian weddings. Here's a new family unit, sir. A new seed of hope. But there's nothing automatic that just because the name of Christian is applied, wise teaching will go on. We'll have to go on reinforcing and strengthening ourselves as parents. We must see part of the object of why we meet together like this, to do just that. Now, those of us who want to be wise parents and wise teachers, in any shape or form, we'll need to learn that we might pass on. I'll just turn over a couple of pages, will you, and look again at the beginning of chapter 4. See chapter 4, verse 1. Listen, my sons, to a father's instruction. Pay attention and gain understanding. I give you sound learning, so don't forsake my teaching. Here's where I got it from, verse 3. When I was a boy in my father's house, still tender and an only child of my mother, he taught me. I wonder if we really see our ministries in multiplication terms. Because we need to. need to be passing on to the next generation. If I'm teaching a group, I need to teach those so they may teach others. Ah, yes, we've got to teach one another to be wisdom teachers. There's no point in having a false dependency on Trevor and Talia and the Sunday school. I don't say this against them in the slightest. I know perfectly well they think this way. They can reinforce, and those of us who are parents are more than grateful for the helping that comes in the Sunday school, but they'll never be able to teach the range of things we'll see next week. Now, we're going to have to put this subject on the agenda amongst ourselves, aren't we? When parents meet, when a home group is together and there are parents there, do we talk about how we bring up our children to be wise? Or those of us who are husbands and fathers, do we just leave it to the wives and mothers? I hope you noticed what Paul said. Fathers, do not exasperate your children, but bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. See, we're talking, we've probably seen enough already to realize this, we're talking, aren't we, about more than a program. I'm not just talking about family prayers at breakfast. Or if you're the wise teacher, we're talking about more than the Wednesday night meeting when your home group or your Read, Mark, Learn group meets. You can't do it just in the formal slot. Let me finish with this story, a fascinating story I read about Boswell, Samuel Johnson's biographer, and his father. And a day he once spent as a child fishing with his father, which clearly had been a significant day. It had changed his life significantly for the better in many ways. He often referred to a number of the lessons that he'd been taught by his father that day. And someone picked up Boswell's father's journal once and came across his father's entry for that day. In the journal, his father had written, "Gone fishing today with my son. A day wasted." I think that is an even greater compliment to Boswell's father. Had no idea the value of that day. And I doubt that any of us will be wise parents or wise teachers unless we're willing to waste a day with our children or those we're discipling. Quite a task, isn't it? Listen, my son, to your father's instruction, and don't forsake your mother's teaching. There'll be a garland to grace your head and a chain to adorn your neck. Now let's pray together. Our gracious God and our loving Heavenly Father, all of us who are parents will want to confess to you our own failings and our weaknesses. But we want this morning especially to pray for Mike and for Liz as they take on their responsibilities towards Flora and Harry, and to pray for each and every parent in this congregation and each and every teacher. Grant us the grace to so control our priorities and to so study and learn ourselves and listen that we might be wise in our handling of those you bring into our responsibility, and that we might have the joy of wise children for your name's sake. Amen.